Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Serpent's Tooth, a memoir by Nancy Marston, narrated by Nancy Marston. To my mother, who taught me right from wrong, who taught me to always do the right thing, it is to you I am most grateful. A lie can travel halfway around the world before truth has a chance to put its shoes on. Chapter 1. As I walked up the concrete courthouse steps that first day of the trial, I was still asking myself why. Why did she do it, after all that had happened, after the disbelief, after the denial, after the anger and dismay? Still to this day, there was a gnawing, insatiable yearning for an answer. I needed something to grab hold of, something that gave me some truth, an answer that made sense. If I could just understand why my daughter had done this, perhaps it could open a doorway to a peace I had yet to find. If I could have imagined the ideal daughter, it would have been Natalie. She was precociously smart and gifted with rare beauty, but she wasn't your typical showbiz kid. Even after people began to recognize her on the street, even after her films were playing all over town and her commercials on national television, she was still thoughtful and effortlessly kind, a blonde-haired, hazel-eyed, double-dimpled beam of energy who lit up the space around her. I remember so clearly the day that set us on that fateful path. It was like an Indian summer afternoon, an unseasonably warm spring day, my favorite time of year to be alive in Southern California. The sun shone through puffy cotton ball clouds as I dozed on a lounge chair on my backyard patio. A warm breeze crossed my face, lulling me to sleep. It was almost time to go pick up Natalie from school when the sliding glass door opened with a swoosh. Maury walked over and took a seat next to me. He had come off his shift at the fire department earlier that morning and had been pitter-pattering around the yard for several hours, pulling a few weeds and playing catch with our dogs. I called it his decompression time. After 24 hours at the hectic fire station, alarms going off, fire engines roaring, it was time to unwind. "Hey, I'll go with you to pick up Natalie. We can go look at that couch you were thinking about, then maybe go get a bite to eat." "You woke me up," I teased him. "Sorry," he laughed, leaning down to kiss my forehead. After waiting in the pickup line, cars bumper to bumper, slowly making their way through the carpool circle, we finally saw our little scholar waving frantically as she ran toward us. She opened the car door with an all-her-strength pull and jumped in, throwing her pink princess backpack to the floor. "I'm glad you're both here. I have so much to tell you," she squealed. We always knew she would fill us in detail by detail, leaving nothing out of another eventful day in kindergarten. "Before you get started," I was attempting to slow her down, "we're going to the furniture store to show Dad that couch we liked, and then to an early dinner." "Yay," she screamed with glee. "I'll save everything until we're eating. You'll have to wait to hear my exciting news." I glanced at Maury and rolled my eyes. "I saw that," she giggled. A few minutes later, we pulled up to the parking lot of the furniture store and found a spot at the front. Barely stepping into the entry of the showroom, we could see the salesman weaving his way toward us through the maze of L-shapes and lazy boys. "Hi there, I'm Mitch." I immediately saw him noticing Natalie. When he got to us, he knelt in front of her almost reflexively. "Your daughter is just gorgeous." "Thank you," I politely said, thinking it was part of a sales pitch, then realizing suddenly that it wasn't. "Ever thought of getting her into commercials?" He was standing now. "No, not really," I answered quickly to put him off. People were constantly telling me she should be a model, or an actress, or something. But Mitch was already hustling over to his desk, parked behind a little bamboo tiki screen. He came trotting back with a framed black-and-white headshot of his daughter, who appeared to be about the same age as Natalie, give or take a year or two. "Katie has booked 2 commercials so far, and she loves it." He dug out a card from his wallet with the name of her manager and handed it to me. "Give Nina a call," he said. "Your daughter seems perfect for it. They're always looking for kids with a little spark." After he sold us the couch I'd fallen in love with and handed the delivery paperwork to me, he leaned in almost conspiratorially. I was a little hesitant too at first, but it's been a lot of fun. "And you'll love Nina. She's the best Hollywood has to offer." I just smiled a weak smile and dropped her card into the Grand Canyon depths of my purse. It was all very flattering, but like everyone else, we'd heard the stories of child actors whose lives had gone horribly wrong. Besides, there was plenty of attention on Natalie already, but this did seem different. It was the first time we've met someone who was actually in the business, with a real live manager and agent. And after talking with Mitch, the idea seemed more real, less daunting. It appeared his daughter was enjoying it, wasn't she? For the next week, I seemed to come across Nina's card every time I fished in my purse. "I'm thinking about maybe calling this manager," I finally said to Maury one day. I had the card in my hand, idly fingering it, flipping it from front to back. "You know, just to see, no strings," I shook my head. I was sitting in an overstuffed chair in our upstairs master, watching him change into his uniform before leaving on another 24-hour shift, his third one that week. The morning sun was just rising, and it blinded me as it angled through the window behind him, so I couldn't really see the reaction on his face. "You know how I feel about it," he said, as he buttoned his shirt from top to bottom, his fingers twisting each one through the holes. He wasn't a big man, but typical of a firefighter, every muscle was in play. "We've never been given a business card before, though. It seems more, you know, real, I guess." I wasn't very convincing, but I was trying. We always discussed things first, and this was just one more subject that needed to be talked about. We were both torn. He nodded his head doubtfully. That much I could see. "Maybe it's sort of a sign we should look into it. At least call the number. Probably nothing will come of it, and, you know, we can move on." Maury wasn't much for signs, but he finally agreed. Like so many life-changing decisions, it was little more than a whim born of curiosity. After he left for work, still able to hear the sound of his truck driving down our street, I dialed the number on the card. The line picked up on the second ring, was fumbled as if dropped, then a voice aged in bourbon coughed hello. I started to explain who I was, but she abruptly cut me off. "Oh yeah, I heard about your daughter from Mitch. When can you bring her by?" "I'm good at 10 tomorrow. Can you make it here that early from, where are you at, Cucamonga?" "Sure." I didn't want to sound too overly anxious, but after all, I was the one with the goods. "Great, the address is on the card. You know Burbank? We'll find it." It was that fast. So on April Fool's Day, the only day to head for Hollywood, as Ray Bradbury wrote, off we went to Tinseltown, an hour's drive from our quiet little hamlet of Rancho Cucamonga. Maury was captain at a neighboring city fire department, and with my degree in psychology, I worked in the mental health unit at a nearby private hospital. In other words, we were a couple of green Dorothys about to land in a world we knew absolutely nothing about. After the stop and going of the early morning traffic clogging the freeways into Los Angeles, we exited the 134 in Burbank. We could see the Sorcerer's Hat soaring into the sky over Disney Studios, the mecca for child actors, and NBC Studios, where Natalie would film many times in the years to come. We pulled up in front of Nina's home office, perfectly groomed, with visuals of Burbank in the 50s, down each street off Buena Vista and Olive. Natalie skipped several yards ahead of us up to the front door, stretched up on her tippy toes, and rang the bell. A moment later, the door swung open, and we got our first gander at Nina. She was a creature indigenous to Hollywood, a big, blousy woman in her early 50s, with wild, unkempt, bleached blonde hair, the dark roots proving overdue at the salon. She had makeup caked on thick as icing and bright red lipstick without borders. She was wearing a tight black spandex dress, a few sizes too small and too short and very low cut, that served up her big blubbery boobs. She had overpowdered her face and breasts, so the talc was everywhere, on her dress, in her hair, on the floor. She took one look at Natalie and swooned like a 30s starlet. "What a beautiful little girl. You must be Natalie." Her voice crackled through a telling smile. Most five-year-olds would be holding tight to their mother when confronted with a vision like Nina, but that wasn't Natalie. She said thank you to the compliment and walked right up to her, reaching out to shake Nina's hand. And just as we knew she would, she started chatting amiably, busily drawing Nina into her charming orbit. I saw the manager's smile slowly grow, until finally she looked up with the unmistakable gleam of dollar signs in her eyes. "Come on, get your car and follow me." And she grabbed a black straw hat amidst a cloud of powder. "I'm going to take her to an agent I work with at 20th. Vivian will absolutely love her." A minute later, a pearly white convertible Seville with burgundy seats screeched up next to us. The top was down, and Nina gave a little this-way wave of her red-tipped talons. Then off she flew, holding onto her hat with one hand and the steering wheel with the other. She took the Barham Boulevard shortcut, past all the studios where Natalie would one day be working, past Warner Brothers and Universal. She barreled her way through the thin thoroughfares of West Hollywood. I lost her several times around corners, but managed with Maury pointing directions to quickly find her again. "Oh, there she is," he'd shout. "Where? Take the next left." Racing through narrow streets lined with trees and parked cars, I strangled the steering wheel as we squeezed through a blind of glinting metal and kicked up leaves. "Are we out of our minds?" I kept mumbling. Nina finally hung a left in front of oncoming traffic into the underground parking of a high-rise on Sunset. With a little Ave Maria, I followed close behind her, accompanied by a fusillade of horns. When the elevator doors opened onto the 10th floor, we stepped into a bustling space amid kids running around like it was a Friday night birthday party at Chuck E. Cheese. With half a nod, Nina shuffled us past the receptionist. She was one of the most influential managers of child actors in Hollywood, known to have an eye for talented kids, so she didn't have to bother with formalities, such as waiting patiently like everyone else. We followed her into the offices of Vivian Hollander of 20th Century Artists. We would later learn she was a New York transplant whose three sons had all been child actors. She was as far from Nina in dress and manner as Lemon from Matthau. A real sharp cookie, as my father used to say, of people he admired, dressed in a dark two-piece suit with short cropped hair that meant business. In less than 15 minutes, we were signing talent agency papers for a 3-year contract. It all seemed so easy, except what had happened that day almost never happens. Hundreds of kids every week tried to get in to see Vivian and agents like her, but most were weeded out by a phalanx of gatekeeper assistants. So only a few ever met with an agent, and of those, only the very special, with high potential in the eyes of the agents, were signed to an agency contract. Nina and Vivian were battle-cured veterans in the Hollywood child actor wars. They handed out rejections like toothbrushes from a dentist while waiting for that rare kid to come their way. Often the rejection was based on need. If they already have a kid with the look, there's no need for another, and the headshot hits the shredder. So when they spotted Natalie, they knew from experience and instinct that she was money in Mary Jane's. Of course, we didn't know any of that at the time, or that Vivian Hollander booked more business than any other children's agent in Hollywood. "Happy man's welcome to Hollywood, what's your dream?" ran through my head like a broken record, over and over. Driving home, I looked in the rearview mirror at our 5-year-old daughter in the back seat. Natalie was tiny for her age, so whenever we traveled, she still rode in a car seat, which she didn't mind because that way she was able to see out the window. She held her pink CD player on her lap, listening through earphones to her favorite song at the time, Neil Diamond's Cherry Cherry. She loved that song, and for easily the millionth time, she was singing along in her tiny voice. It was heartbreakingly adorable. "God, I hope we're doing the right thing," I quietly said to Maury, shaking my head. My itch having been scratched, I was now into the guilt-riddled portion of my whim. She's so young. If she doesn't like it, or we don't like what we see, we'll pull the plug. He was always the voice of reason. It was comforting. Maury ran his own fire crew as captain, and the strength in his voice reassured me. He was the financial rock of the family, which would eventually allow me to quit my job to look after Natalie's career. Still, despite the uncertainty, I confess I was terrifyingly thrilled by the exhilarating ride we found ourselves on. Then the world, as it has a way of doing, put the brakes on my little reverie. Later that month, 4 police officers went on trial for the beating of Rodney King. Within minutes, possibly even seconds, of the not guilty verdict, Los Angeles exploded. Fires ignited here and there and everywhere. In no time, South Central was choked by the smoke of 7,000 separate fires. Looters rampaged through the streets, men, women, and 10-year-olds. Gunshots peppered the night like popcorn pop-pop-popping. 63 people were killed, and nearly 3,000 were hospitalized before the rage finally died out. Natalie wasn't called out on a single audition for more than 6 months, but neither was anyone else, Productions were shut down, shoots canceled, and there was a mass exodus of actors fleeing to New York to find work. But when production finally started up again, Natalie's successes came in a rush. In January 1993, Natalie went on her first audition for a commercial. It was for Treasure Troll's newborns, Baby Doll, which would turn out to be a big winner the following Christmas. The next day, she went on a callback, which meant they wanted to take a second look at some of the talent. Most of the time, the producers of a commercial or film narrow their choices down to a handful of actors, then they call back a few of them to help make their final decision. The following day in Vivian's office, Nina air kissed Natalie and me as she told us the news. Guess what? You got the commercial. Though her manager was standing at the time, Natalie actually leaped into Nina's lap, giggling with excitement. The serious, level-headed Vivian was more sober. I want to tell you something. She had pinned both Natalie and me, a hand on each of our shoulders, and her tone was serious as she prepared to make herself very clear. Nobody goes on their first audition and books a national commercial. Nobody. She was shaking her head as she said it. She was pleased, but she also seemed a little bewildered, as if she were a big game trapper who had stumbled upon a playful cuddle of lion cubs. Where was the killer mother about to pounce? Nobody, she repeated, mostly to herself. Nina gave us a wide-eyed nod of agreement. I've never seen it. The commercial was a buyout, which meant no residuals or royalties, but we didn't care. We were thrilled that Natalie had gotten the job, but Vivian Hollander, her tough-as-asphalt agent, wasn't at all happy about it. She thought the producer had gotten away with one because Natalie was new to the scene. Vivian knew my daughter's value, so after that she made sure all Natalie's commercials were union. The pay was always scale, what the Screen Actors Guild, or SAG, pays for a day's work, and residuals followed after the spot aired. And as we soon found out, it didn't take long for that to happen. From the start, we promised Natalie this was going to be a fun adventure, so we booked a room the night before the shoot at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel on iconic Hollywood Boulevard. Opened in 1927, it hosted famous movie stars from Clark Gable to Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra to Elizabeth Taylor. The Roosevelt is known for the many stories surrounding alleged hauntings by several former guests. But after a disappointing night of no paranormal sightings, we got up early and headed over to the set just a few short miles away. The commercial shoot was a fantasy come to life for a six-year-old girl. The set looked as if it had been spun from cotton candy, decorated in pink frills, pink walls, pink carpet, and a pink rocking chair for Natalie to snuggle with her doll. There was even a window with artificial sunlight streaming through its pink lacy curtains, projecting rainbow beams across the room. Natalie wore light pink flannel pajamas with matching bunny slippers, and they tied a pink satin ribbon in her long blonde hair, which at the time came nearly to her knees. She spent the day being treated like a princess. Throughout the day, the production assistant picked her up several times and carried her across the set so that her bunny slippers stayed pristine. She hugged, rocked, and fell asleep with her baby, jingle music playing in the background. Then, while holding the doll in her arms, Natalie cooed her first spoken line. I wish everyone could be as happy as we are. For a first job, the Treasure Trolls commercial was a great start. Natalie was in 6 of the 9 scenes they shot that day. It gave both of us experience in the process of auditioning and booking, not to mention a day of union scale pay that included contracts, wardrobe fittings, set teachers, storyboards, and grips. More importantly, I saw how thrilled my daughter was. She immediately loved every second of it. And throughout it all, she grinned and giggled as giddily as she did when she rode the teacups at Disneyland. Within a month after her first shoot, Natalie booked 2 more national commercials, one for the LA Times, then one for auto giant Chevrolet. This third commercial booking caused a forced join into the Screen Actors Guild. This meant she would have to join the union before she could film the next commercial. So an hour before the Chevrolet wardrobe fitting, we drove to SAG headquarters on Wilshire, completed the paperwork, and paid the initiation fee, plus first quarter dues. And just like that, my 6-year-old daughter, who had only recently graduated from kindergarten, had her own SAG card. A mere 6 months into her career, Natalie booked her first Barbie commercial. The people at Mattel are very particular about who they choose to appear with their icon. The girls need to be very pretty, of course, no characters with spiky red hair, or goofy smiles and a missing tooth, which might be an asset for a Bad News Bears comedy, but not for the sparkling world of a Barbie fantasy. She must also have meticulously manicured hands and nails, perfect teeth, and gorgeous hair. All little girls in the business only dream of booking a prestigious Barbie shoot, but Natalie booked them one right after another. In fact, she always had at least one Barbie commercial running nationally, sometimes internationally, for 7 straight years. The window for Barbie starts at 7 and ends at 9 years old for most girls. Natalie booked her last Barbie commercial at 12 years old. She was so well liked by Mattel. And it wasn't unusual for 2 to air concurrently, often during the holiday season when all the little girls were pleading with Santa for the newest version of Barbie. By the end of her first full year, she had booked 5 national commercials. Between Christmas and New Year's, typically a very slow time for actors, Vivian called with the exciting news that Natalie had booked a Disney film. It was called Bad Dates, starring veteran film and television actors Nancy Travis from 3 Men and a Baby and the television hit Becker, and Alan Ruck from Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Spin City. It was Des McAniffs, director of the Tony Award-winning stage play Tommy, film directing debut. So the whirlwind began to swirl a little faster for us. The filming of Bad Dates took place in Canyon Country, just east of the San Fernando Valley, at an abandoned elementary school. Replaced by the new, the building was soon to be demolished. At least that's what we heard. It was most definitely run down, in need of repair, with only the bare necessities, but it made a perfect classroom setting for a movie. So in mid-January, we drove up the 5 freeway and connected to the 14 for our first day on the Bad Date set. It went well, but before our next day of shooting, Mother Nature took a hand. On the morning of January 17th, just before sunrise, we were awakened by the violent shaking of our house as the 1994 Northridge earthquake hit California. Even though the epicenter was nearly 60 miles from Rancho Cucamonga, we rocked like the quake was directly under us. With a magnitude of 6.7, it shook the Los Angeles area with a vengeance, collapsing houses and freeway overpasses. Within seconds, it left nearly $25 billion in property damages, making it the costliest natural disaster to date. Along with the tremendous price tag, 57 people were killed and over 10,000 injured. We were due back on the Bad Date set the following day, but a high-sweeping 14 freeway overpass that we had driven just hours prior had collapsed, sadly taking the life of an LAPD motorcycle officer. It would take many months to repair the damage. There was only one way around it, the long way through Palmdale, to a Super 8 motel where we were put up by production for the next week. Anyone who knows me knows it wasn't exactly my style, but the kids loved it, turning every night after filming into a bouncing slumber party. Of course, I worried myself into a frenzy about the aftershocks, and there were plenty in the retired elementary school, and the motel for that matter, one, then another, and another. They rumbled and they shook the ground under us, not to mention my frazzled nerves. We made it through that week of filming, but I have to say I was never happier to wrap a shoot. A few months later, we were invited to a screening at Disney Studios in Burbank. The Bad Dates production team, actors, and crew were all there to celebrate. It was our little actress's first Hollywood gala event. She dressed the part in a fancy dress, accessorized with black cowgirl boots and a matching felt hat, just like a movie star ready to pose for her photo. As we headed into her second year in the business, I paused to think about all the signs, riots, an earthquake, and looming SAG after strikes every few months. But I brushed them off, knowing we had never even had a flat tire or been forced to pull over by the side of the road with car troubles. We've been lucky so far, I thought to myself. No really bad signs, so carry on. Natalie had shot to the top of the commercial world with Barbie shoots and her first featured role in a Disney film. She was rapidly entering the world of theatrical work, with a dramatic uptick in exposure, prestige, and pay that performing in film and television brings. No matter how talented a child actor is, however, there is no magic wand that can be waved. It takes a team that includes agents, managers, acting coaches, set teachers, photographers, and of course, a good set of parents. It was easy to see that Natalie had a passion for what she was doing, but it was up to me to handle the logistics. Thankfully, I had always been highly organized, juggling two children, a firefighter's schedule, and myself in college, so we quickly fell into a well-oiled routine. Many afternoons, I would pick Natalie up from school and drive straight into LA for an audition or callback. I'd have a change of clothes for her and her makeup and hair case we fondly called the caboodle. It was filled with everything we needed for a quick spruce-up before an audition. It had a purple lid, a green bottom, and a pink handle and latch, all bright colors Natalie loved. Inside it had trays that opened with a big mirror and even a sharpener for eyeliners. I made sure the caboodle was well-stocked with hair brushes, bobby pins, hair clips, and ribbons, along with a toothbrush and toothpaste. It even had an on-the-go butane-powered curling iron for last-minute curls to the bottom of her long blonde hair. When we arrived at an audition, we would sign in, then quickly head to the ladies' room to freshen up. When finished, we'd head back to the waiting area for her name to be called, but we never had to rush too much because the wait was nearly always tediously long. Natalie carried the caboodle in and out of auditions well into her teens, and because she was so little, it doubled as a place to sit until she was at least 10 years old. Then it conveniently became a footstool. Along with talent, a child actor needs to be able to handle incredible responsibilities. The risk and the monies at stake are huge, even on the smallest budget production. This meant there was very little room for mistakes or lack of preparation, especially when it came to memorization. We spent much of our time in the car going over her lines, preparing a scene for an audition or shoot, while I doubled as the driver and acting coach. Hollywood legend has it that Shirley Temple not only knew her lines cold, she knew everyone else's as well. When another actor forgot their lines, she'd call them out to them. If you hung around Hollywood kids the way I did for many years, you would have no problem believing this story. The kids are articulate, funny, responsible, and very, very bright, or they simply don't make it in the business. The next few years, Natalie continued to book steadily, appearing in commercial after commercial and landing a number of dramatic roles. Despite her success, I was not blind to the troubles and tragedies of child actors such as River Phoenix, Lindsay Lohan, Amanda Bynes, and Hilary Duff. My daughter auditioned with or acted alongside many of them, and as a parent, I was naturally very concerned about the effects this world and this success might have on my child. The last thing we wanted was for our adventure to turn into a tragedy. My strategy was to make sure that Natalie's entire life was not just about acting and show business. I wanted her to experience as many things as possible so she could find her passions and interests. She was in Girl Scouts and weekly dance classes, tap, ballet, and jazz, as well as t-ball and soccer, which she loathed because there were way too many boys on the teams. She took singing and voice lessons and piano, which she loved and was quite good at. Plus, it added to her blossoming resume. Around 7, Natalie became obsessed with horses, as only a prepubescent girl can. She rode English style with a black velvet helmet, tight stretched pants, and brown leather riding boots, her long hair touching the saddle. Natalie always dressed immaculately and was very aware of the newest styles, always a step ahead of the Paris runway. But when she was around horses, she was a saddle tramp. Her nails caked with dirt, her hair pulled back and wrapped in a sweaty bandana. Brushing her horse and cleaning its stall were her favorite things to do. Even shoveling poop she did without complaint. It was a long way from the pampering she got when on a Hollywood set, and it assured me that Natalie was smoothly sailing the sea of attention that came with her love affair with acting. Chapter 2. When my 12-year-old daughter landed a role in the much-anticipated upcoming feature film, Magnolia, she entered the universe of blockbuster movies. This was a film with mature subjects directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, PTA to his friends, a high-energy powerhouse who would go on to direct Oscar-winning films, including There Will Be Blood. But at this point, he had only recently mesmerized Hollywood with the audacious success of Boogie Nights, set in the 70s, about porn star Dirk Diggler. PTA was nominated for an Academy Award for both screenwriting and directing, and the film had been a financial bonanza for the studio and distributors. Oscars and box office are Hollywood's heroine, the highs only this business are known for. So the biggest names in feature films were pestering him to become involved in his next project. Many of the same actors who had appeared in Boogie Nights, including Julianne Moore, Philip Seymour Hoffman, William H. Macy, John C. Reilly, Alfred Molina, and Louise Guzman, had eagerly signed on for Magnolia without a second thought.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?